Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation as part of the club's Good Lit series. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org or on Facebook, Twitter, and our YouTube channel. I am Eddie Muller, author and founder and president of the Film Noir Foundation, and your moderator for tonight. Okay, I'm going off script now. In 1958, a woman named Geneva Hilliker was murdered in the wasteland of Southern California. And when the cops and the press descended on her home, there was a flash pop photograph of her 10-year-old son looking a little lost and bewildered in that photograph. Several years later, in an attempt to try to sort of explain what had happened, his father gave him a copy of the book The Badge by Jack Webb, which contained numerous ghastly crime stories set in Los Angeles that were too horrifying to appear on the Dragnet television series. That young boy would end up being your worst nightmare from high school, that kid that you couldn't stand in your high school class. He had a nice little record of petty crimes. The LAPD juked him up and handed him his ass and sort of got him straight. He became a caddy at country clubs, and he discovered crime fiction, which started to make sense of everything that was roiling around in his head. He had the audacity to write his first book, go to New York, drop it on the desk of the legendary Otto Penzler, who knows more about crime fiction than anybody else in America, and announced, "I am the next great one." I'll be damned if he wasn't. Yes, he wrote a series of five books featuring a character named Lloyd Hopkins that sort of announced his arrival. And then with the publication of The Black Dahlia, he managed to lift crime fiction into the realm of actual literature. And not being at a loss for ambition, that was only the first book in what became the L.A. Quartet, consisting of The Big Nowhere, L.A. Confidential, and White Jazz. Not being satisfied with Los Angeles as a canvas, he decided to write the shadow history of America. American history is a crime story, after all. And he proceeded to write American Tabloid, The Cold 6000, and Blood's a Rover. And in there, he wrote absolutely stunning nonfiction, My Dark Places, about his mother's murder and his lifelong pursuit of answers in that crime. Obviously, you're familiar that a lot of his books have been turned into very successful movies, including L.A. Confidential, one of the best crime films ever made. And now we are here because he has returned to the scene of the crime, Los Angeles, in the early 1940s for his latest book, Perfidia, which unfolds in Los Angeles over 23 days, beginning on December 6, 1941. And you all know what happens the following day. So please join me in welcoming our distinguished guest, that 10-year-old kid who had something, something going on inside. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. James Ellroy.
Good evening, audience. Good evening, Joan. Joan, I've been thinking of you. God bless you, and thank you for coming. I appreciate it. Mr. Muller appreciates it. We realize that you had options tonight. You could have stayed home and attended to your sex lives and your drug habits and your neurotic and ungrateful children, but you didn't. You came here to catch our act, and we are nothing but happy about that. T.S. Eliot wrote, "In my end is my beginning, and in my beginning is my end." Ross MacDonald wrote, "In the end, I possess my birthplace and am possessed by its language." I was lucky. Geography is destiny. my parents hatched me in the film noir epicenter at the height of the film noir era. I grew up in the manner that Eddie Muller described. I have voluntarily ignored the entire digital age. I don't have a cell phone. I have written all my books by hand, and I immerse myself in the past. I have a grand design for the next decade of my life. I am going to write the second LA Quartet, taking characters, real life and fictional, from the first two extended bodies of work that Eddie described and placed them in Los Angeles during World War II as significantly younger people. The first volume of the second LA Quartet is Perfidia. Perfidia is a marvelous big band era tune. It's been copied many, many times. It comes from the word betrayal in Spanish. A Latin-speaking man wrote the song, man named Gonzalez. Glenn Miller recorded it notably with the Modern Airs. It goes on and on. There's a surf beat, Perfidia. The Ventures recorded it in rock and roll stereo in 1961. It's part of the Schtickmeister review, Forever Plaid. It is a song that will not go away, and it is the plaintive lament of yearning souls the month that America entered World War II. Perfidia is the story of America at the edge of the abyss and the precipice of our ascendance. It's a 700-page novel. It's told in real time. It's an alcohol, sex, and drug binge. It's 23 days when we thought we were going to be blasted to shit by Japanese air and sea squadrons. It's the expose of a grave injustice, the Japanese internment. Tonight, I will read the prologue and a few short paragraphs from the book itself, and then I will sit down with Eddie Muller, the Tsar of Noir, and after we confabulate for the better part of an hour, it would be our pleasure to answer the most invasively provocative and overpersonal questions that each and every one of you peepers, prowlers, pederasts, pedants, panty sniffers, punks, and pimps has for us. Perfidia. Reminiscenza. I wandered off in a prairie village 85 years ago. The snow rendered me spellbound then to now. I have outlived the decree and find myself afraid to die. I cannot will cloudbursts the way I once did. I must recollect with yet greater fury. It was a fever then. It remains a fever now. I will not die as long as I live this story. I run to then to buy myself moments now. 23 days, blood libel. A policeman knocks on a young woman's door. Murderer's flags a swirl. 23 days, this storm, reminiscenza. Chapter 2, Kay Lake's Diary, compiled and chronologically inserted by the Los Angeles Police Museum. Los Angeles, Saturday, December 6th, 1941, 11:23 a.m. I've begun this diary on impulse. An extraordinary scene unfolded as I sat on my separate bedroom terrace. I was sketching the southern view and heard the rumble of engines below me on the strip. I immediately got up and wrote down this precise time and date. I sensed what the rumble portended, and I was right. A line of armored vehicles chugged west on Sunset to fevered scrutiny and applause. It took a full 10 minutes for the armada to pass. The noise was loud, the cheers louder. People stopped their cars to get out and salute the young soldiers. It played hell with the flow of traffic, but no one seemed to care. The soldiers were delighted by this display of respect and affection. They waved and blew kisses. A half dozen waitresses from Dave's Blue Room ran out and passed them cases of liquor. Somebody shouted, "America!" And that's when I knew. The war is coming. I'm going to enlist. I always do what I say I'm going to do. I formally state my intent and proceed from that point. I am going to write a diary entry every day until the present world conflict concludes or the world blows up. I will walk away from my easy existence and seek official postings near the front lines. I live a dilettante's life now. My compulsive sketch artistry is a schoolgirl's attempt to capture confounding realities. My piano studies, an emerging proficiency with the easier Chopin nocturnes, stall my pursuit of a true cause. This lovely home in no way allays my psychic discomfort. Lee Blanchard's indulgence is disconcerting more than anything else. This diary is a broadside against stasis and unrest. I have always felt superior to my surroundings. This house states that case most tellingly. I picked out every German expressionist print and every stick of blonde wood furniture. I'm a prairie girl from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and a gifted Aravist. I'm moving into my separate bedroom now. My own work is arrogantly displayed on the walls, interspersed with Clay and Kandinsky. There are a dozen drawings of a light heavyweight named Bucky Bleichert. He has a hungry young man's body and large bucked teeth. I have sketched him many times from ringside seats at the Olympic. Bucky Bleichert is a local celebrity who understands the ephemeral quality of celebrity and does not view boxing as a true cause. His circumspection in the ring delights me. I have never spoken to Bucky Bleichert, but I am certain that I understand him. Because I was a local celebrity once. It was February of 39. I was 19. It all pertained to a bank robbery and its alleged solution. This house, a refuge a few years ago, a trap now. The robbery got me this house, not Lee's prudently invested fight winnings. Lee Blanchard is not a savvy investor, as is commonly held, nor is he my lover in the common sense. He entered my life to facilitate my destiny, whatever it is. I know that now. Sioux Falls was an insufficient destiny. The winter cold spells and summer heat waves left people dead. Indians strayed from nearby reservations and stabbed one another in speakeasies. Klansman broke a Negro man out of the county jail. He was accused of raping a dim-witted white girl. The Klansman convened a kangaroo court. The girl was slow to condemn or exonerate the man accused. The Klansman staked him over a red anthill in mid-August. The summer sun, or the ants, killed him. Local lore was divided on this. Protestants despised the few local Catholics. Nativist groups flourished throughout the Depression. Methodists were at odds with Lutherans and Baptists, and vice versa. A range war over prize cattle broke out in 34. 14 men were killed near the Iowa border. My parents and older brother were sweet-natured and content. Their only sin was their lack of imagination. I pretended to be one of them in order to live within myself unobstructed. I lived to read, draw, and roam. People talked about me. I dropped racy bon mots in church and caused stirs. I did not care about my family. That fact mildly horrified me. I wanted to run away to Los Angeles and become someone else there. I got a job at a bookstore and stole a month's worth of cash receipts. I left my parents a perfunctory note of farewell. It was November 36. I was 16. The bus ride featured dust storms and a flash flood near Albuquerque. Armed goons were stationed at the California border. They were charged to keep indigent Okies out. They were moonlighting L.A. policemen. It was the first portent of my destiny. The armored convoy has passed out of range. I felt a rumble. It suddenly left my body. Nothing before this moment exists. The war is coming. I'm going to enlist.
It's interesting that you chose that passage to read, because it's one of the few extended passages of introspection in the book.
Eddie, I have to disagree with you on that. And I did write the book. There is more introspection in this book than my last seven novels combined. My characters, Dudley Smith, Hideo Ishida, Kay Lake, and William H. Parker, the real-life policeman who had ultimately come, the great reforming chief of LAPD, constantly think and ponder meaning.
Well, true enough. The reason I point that out, though, is because what strikes me so much about this book is that it is told in like these split-second fragments that add up to this colossal, epic feat of storytelling. So while, yes, I understand your point that there is constant introspection of all the characters, that is one of the, I mean, this section comes before the action really starts.
It does.
And it's Kay sort of explaining how she ended up in L.A. and who she is. Now, I have to say, I did not realize until this moment that the bit you read at the very start was actually Kay. I didn't realize that.
Yes. Kay Lake, by the way, for the audience, is the heroine of my novel, The Black Dahlia, which I wrote in 1985 and 86 and was published in 87. Thus, this book is the prequel. Kay is 21. Here, 6 years later, she will ultimately marry Bucky Bleichert in The Black Dahlia. But there are no thoughts attributed to Kay Lake. We're never in her actual viewpoint in The Black Dahlia. So nothing in this text here, Perfidia, contradicts the action of the Black Dahlia.
Right.
which leads me to ask, she is the only character that in the book that gets this treatment, where when she, it's her diaries
yes.
that we're reading. And so, in essence, although truthfully, every chapter and every character is really written in the first person.
It's the third person subjective. We're in their thoughts exclusively, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Why did you make that decision to have Kay be the only one that specifically gets that treatment?
I wanted to write a heroic female character. I've always had a big case on Kay Lakin. All right, I created her. You can call it narcissism or onanism, and I stand accused, and justifiably so, dare I say, of all my female characters, right up there with Joan Klein from Bloods Are Over, she's my favorite.
It's a great character. Another observation about the book. This cataclysmic event takes place, yet the war is really just a backdrop for all of these incredible machinations that the characters go through. So it's kind of a fascinating look at the war, because everybody, at times in the course of the novel, I'm not going to give away any spoilers or anything, trust me. What's amazing is that you're 7 days into the war, and a lot of characters are already scheming about the post-war environment
yes.
in Los Angeles. That's sort of what the book is about.
Yeah.
It's about war profiteering more than it's about the war itself, it seems.
It's very true. The war was a tremendous opportunity for land developers, those of a mind to intern innocent Japanese and seize their assets and property, those who thought it was the prudent thing to do as a result of Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor. It's a time of great patriotic fervor, great racial hatred, a hair's breadth away. And it was a time to party and get laid, because there was an egalitarian leveling. The social code flatlined like this. Hence, rogue cops, I won't name names, are having love affairs with the likes of Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, and a B-movie favorite of mine, Eddie, who I know you're hip to, Ellen Drew.
Ellen Drew, yes.
From The Crooked Way.
The alarm bells went off as soon as I read Ellen Drew in the book.
Yeah, will you read the next book? she's back, yes. It was a hell of a time, and it was a time to drink, use drugs, because, as someone ruminates in this book, those swabbies at Pearl didn't know what hit them. We could be next.
Yeah. I'm going to quickly read and make sure the audience gets their questions in. I will do these as we go. Can you speak a little bit about how you organize the plot of a whodunit that keeps the reader guessing?
Of course, these books are much more than whodunits. They're giant social tapestries. Let me get that out of the way. Right at the get-go.
It's true enough. Yeah. True enough. There is a whodunit in the middle of the book.
A Japanese family is murdered in the hours preceding the Pearl Harbor attack. And a big police investigation ensues. Now dig it. The outline for Perfidia was 700 pages. A friend and colleague of mine, a woman who's done research for me in the past, compiled fact sheets and chronologies so that I would be able to impart verisimilitude to you, my beloved readers. I got lucky in one key instance. Perfidia deals largely with the first month of the Japanese internment, the extra-legal, illegal roundups of allegedly subversive Japanese. It was chaotic. It was reported as thus in the L.A. Daily newspapers, so I had that much more latitude to fictionalize. I compiled my own fact sheets and chronologies from my researchers' notes. I combined them with my fictional notes, character notes, plot notes, and then wrote that 700-page outline by hand, had it typed, sent it to my book agent and publisher in New York. They read it. They offered notes. I wrote the damn book.
Now, I know that how you work. Now, I have to say, there's a character, well, I'm just going to come out and say this. I mean, it's Dudley Smith, who's also, if you've read the books, you know Dudley Smith, Sergeant LAPD. There was a point when I was reading the book when you sort of became Dudley Smith to me because of just what you described. The way he graphs everything that he's mixed up in L.A. and has these incredibly complicated hieroglyphs all over his office. You know, it seems like the way you work. Do you share any other similarities with Dudley Smith?
We're both tall, handsome, look good in a navy blazer, and an anachronistic bow tie. He sleeps with Betty Davis. I've spent hours and hours fascinated and obsessing. I get to rewrite history to my own specifications. I get to bomb Pearl Harbor. I get to intern innocent Japanese. I get to sleep with Betty Davis and Joan Crawford. I get to live in Kay Lake's Seoul, solve astonishingly complex times, have all kinds of chemical misconduct, and nobody gets hurt. It's a benign form of megalomania.
Do you have any sense of responsibility when you use an actual person fictionally, like Bill Parker, like Whiskey Bill, or even, let's say, Betty Davis, who has like full-blown scenes in the book? I mean, what's your attitude about that? Is it just fun, or do you ever feel like, is this okay to actually be doing this?
You know, Bet, I honored you. I'm talking, listen, sister. Yeah. Okay, we had a thing when I was 3 and you were 45, but I don't want to tell anybody about it. Let's just say I was precocious, Betty. I honored you by portraying you as you really were, and I'll see you on the other side, and if you're pissed, find me, and we'll talk. She's indelible. She steals the 7 scenes that she's in, and I believe I have imparted verisimilitude in the matter of her character. Her isolation, her brittleness, her strength, her patriotic fervor, and her astonishing flintiness, willfulness, and abominable self-pity.
It's a good character.
I
think you did well by her.
Yeah.
It seems to me that one of the themes in your books is this, is order. Like, how do you keep order in a completely out-of-control world? And obviously, in your books, this falls to the Los Angeles Police Department. And they very often run roughshod over the law in their attempts to maintain order. More than any other writer, you have created this malevolent view of the police. Yet every year, you are the MC of the Jack Webb Awards for the Los Angeles Police Historical Society. I want to ask you, how do you walk this incredibly fine line?
I am William H. Parker. William H. Parker, although, and may he rest in peace, he's the greatest American policeman of the 20th century. He was chief of the LAPD from 1950 to 1966. I chart his life in 1941, when he was 39 years old, and a captain in the traffic division. He's me on my deepest levels. He is my piety. He is my profligacy. He is my defiance. He is my order. He is my deep, divided, ultimately theocratic soul. I do not have a malevolent view of the Los Angeles Police Department. I have a minority view of the Los Angeles Police Department that, in private conversation, I can back up with facts, with genealogies, and with truthful, valid, anecdotal lore, and tonight's not the time for something that layered and complex. But all of my paradox finds its home in Whiskey Bill Parker. He is the divided American soul confronted with evil without the Axis powers, Russia, Soviet Russia, genocidal itself, looming in the post-war world, because in December 1941, after the bombs dropped on Pearl Harbor, our victory was nothing but a fait accompli. As Admiral Yamamoto said that day, "What I fear we have done is to waken a sleeping giant and fill him with a terrible resolve." And he was right. And Whiskey Bill Parker rides that zeitgeist, confronting the war within himself, the war with the Axis powers, the war to reform the Los Angeles Police Department, and the Cold War that will follow World War II. Presciently.
Okay. And as a follow-up, someone asks, what is the most perverse slash and or memorable experience you've had with your police friends?
I've had no perverse experiences. I asked a woman detective for a date once, and she told me very bluntly to fuck off. And I don't know why. This was good. Okay. I went to a police event, and I thought I had a vibe with the commander of an LAPD station. Yeah, it was a vibe. Or so I convinced myself. In fact, it was a big, throbbing fucking vibe. And I sent her flowers at the station the following Monday. And two uniformed bruisers showed up at the door of my apartment to set me straight. The captain says no.
I see. There's also a flower-sending scene that goes horribly wrong in this book. Any correlation between those two events?
Eddie, I spent $14,000 one year sending a certain woman flowers. And I totaled it up at the end of the year.
Here's my important question. Did you write it off your taxes? Don't admit that. We're on the radio.
I don't think I did.
Let me get you an accountant, buddy. I want to ask you about, there's a character who plays a very small role in The Black Dahlia who appears in this book in a much more substantial way, and that is Hideo Ishida.
Yes.
The Japanese police, what is he, a forensics guy.
He's a forensic chemist, yes.
I just want you to talk a little bit about that character because he is very, very well drawn. He's a very fascinating character, and he was one of the keys when I'm reading this book that actually took me out of the 40s and made me think of the contemporary ramifications of this book in the sense that he's the person out of sorts. And I was thinking to myself, like, well, what if this guy was, you know, a Muslim or something or an Arab working on the police force today? Would this same thing happen to this character as happens in this book? That's a lot of hooey I just threw at you, but just...
I never think of topical relevance. I never think of the world today because I'm having a blast living in the world today. It's 2014. I'm lean, mean, obscene, and barely into my teens. And life's a gas, but I live in 1941. So don't ask me questions about the world today and what I think of it and how this novel relates. Because I don't know, and it's up to you to draw your own conclusions. I'll tell you some things about Hideo Ishida. He's preternaturally brilliant. He is a closeted homosexual
celibate PhD chemist, physicist, and microbiologist, and the only Japanese American on the Los Angeles Police Department the month the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor and the Japanese internment begins. He is in on half a dozen levels a boatload of shit. And Perfidia is largely the story of his maneuvering through it.
Okay, I just want to remind people, this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking with James Ellroy, best-selling author of L.A. Confidential, The Black Dahlia, and his latest book, Perfidia, and I am Eddie Muller, author and founder and president of the Film Noir Foundation and your moderator for tonight. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. Okay, I want to ask you another question from the audience. For your next quartet, this is the one mm-hmm. you're in the midst of now, are you interviewing World War II vets before they pass on forever?
No, because I make this stuff up.
Okay.
And because I trust myself to do it, I am in the business of creating verisimilitude. It comes from immersion. I've lived in the past my entire life as I've bebopped blithely through the present and into the future. And frankly, we are always in the present. There's no need to. I went to the haunting and moving Japanese American National Museum in Los Angeles. I looked at some pictures. I'll go back before I write the sequel to Perfidia. By and large, I sit in a room with a landline telephone on my big-ass desk with my little Luther Terrace out there so I can go out and foment and try to create a following of my profligate neighbors in the Hollywood Hills. And I listen to classical music, big, brooding pieces. The soundtrack for Perfidia was Perfidia itself, Samuel Barber's plaintive violin concerto, and the piece of music that I think is the greatest work of art in any form of the 20th century, Dmitri Shostakovich's 10th Symphony.
Which isn't, I don't think it's name-checked in the book, though, right? Is it?
No, there's no references to it because he hadn't written it.
Okay, good point. Good point. Several other good musical references in the book, though. One thing we have to talk about, because it's something we both love, and for me it's kind of a guilty pleasure. As you know, my dad was a newspaper man. The media of that time, newspaper primarily, newspaper and radio, television had not really happened yet. It's so glorious.
Yes.
The
yes.
newspaper business of that time, now in hindsight they call it yellow journalism and all that kind of stuff. Oh my God, there was nothing like the newspaper business of the period, which you evoke very well in this book. And you have a character who's a trails along the PD, Sid. Anyway, just your thoughts on I won't bring up media today, obviously, yeah. since you don't follow yeah. media today. But obviously that stuff has informed your writing pretty strongly.
The quote from the beginning of my talk up here, in the end I possess my birthplace and I'm possessed by its language. Ross McDonald's great quote, written near the end of his life. I love the American idiom. I love the rawness of it. I love racial invective in all its forms, more and more censored these days. I love alliteration. I love Yiddish. I love black hepcat junkie talk. I love hard C words spelled with a K. You know the scandal rag writer Sid Hudgens from my book, L.A. Confidential, memorably portrayed by Danny DeVito, the little rodent-like actor who's about this tall. He's outrageous. He speaks in alliterative patois. And here he is back in this book, the month the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Racial invective, alliteration, black hepcat jive talk, hard C words spelled with a K, Klan humor, KKK, at the front of a hard C or hard K word, italicized. Look at it on the page. In the end, I possess my birthplace and am possessed by its language. You love this stuff, Eddie. So do I. It's in both our bloods. Yours more than mine because of your dad.
True enough. It's try as I might to fight it, I can't. I love all that stuff. Okay, important question from the audience. Chick Webb or Artie Shaw?
I'm prone to Artie Shaw because of the tone, because of the fact he was married 9 times. Well, you know, it's nothing when compared to the king, Charlie Barnett. Charlie Barnett, nobody, has anyone in this room even heard of Charlie Barnett?
Yeah.
Raise your hand.
Yeah.
Ever heard of Charlie Barnett? Big, handsome guy, rich kid, U.S. Steel family. He played every reed instrument, soprano sax, alto sax, baritone sax, clarinet, bass clarinet. And he'd do 6 or 7 solos with different instruments in the course of a single piece. And he had them arrayed out here. He was a podium hog. He was a womanizer. He was a grandstander. He was America 1941. And dig it. Okay, he had U.S. Steel money behind him. Married 11 times? I mean, I've been married twice, and I can't comprehend. And my second ex-wife's my best friend. I can't comprehend doing it again. 11 times.
No.
No, really. 5-5-1. More than Artie Shaw. More than Liz Taylor. More than Mickey Rooney. Holy shit.
Okay, this question kind of dovetails then. What advice do you give for talking your partner into naming your dog Hacksaw, Night Train, or Rapo?
I love bull breed dogs. I love American Staffordshire Terriers. I love pit bulls. I love bull terriers, the wedge-headed Spuds McKenzie.
Margaret hated your ass, man.
Margaret, listen, we'll see Margaret, Barco, and Dudley in heaven. You've met Margaret, haven't you?
Oh, yeah.
Margaret was the female alpha bull terrier that Helen Knode, my beloved second ex-wife and best friend, had. We got Margaret the day I got out of rehab when our marriage was on the skids, and she took one look at me and started barking, snapping, and growling, and did so to the end of her long and healthy life. She let me love her and pet her when Helen was in the room, but beyond that, she had no use for me, and I gave her nothing but love.
Yeah, and it was funny. He would tremble in terror when Helen would leave the room. If he was alone in the room with Margaret, it was like, oh, my God, no.
I named her after Margaret Thatcher. She's beautiful. A British bull breed dog. We'll see her on the other side. Good looking motherfucker, too.
This is a pretty serious question. Did DNA ever yield anything regarding your mother's murder?
It did not. No. No. Although DNA is his name, the Jack the Ripper killer. Is that true? Isn't that been in the media? Do you believe it, folks? Is it true? Slobber died?
Okay. Speaking along those lines, Was Lee Harvey Oswald a patsy?
I don't know, and I don't care. That was then, this is now. That's American Tabloid, and I urge you to read it. But my fascination with the Kennedy assassination is long gone. I'm World War II now.
Okay, I heard something. I've heard two things in the past week. You are really on a roll. Number one, that you are going to be writing a, I hate to say a remake, because we talked about it for 12 seconds, and it sounds like a revisionist version of Laura, the movie Laura from 1944. A lot of people just perked up. They know that film very well. What can you tell us about that?
I am writing the remake of Laura. I have wanted this script job for the better part of 20 years. I finally got it a few months ago. It's for 20th Century Fox. And a marvelous producer at Fox 2000 named Elizabeth Gabler, who is the producer of the recent Kids with Cancer blockbuster that's too maudlin for my taste, and The Life of Pi that has a beautiful Bengal tiger in it, but I can't see movies where animals are in jeopardy, even though I know the tiger survives, and handsomely so. Laura is the story of a lonely, haunted police detective named Mark McPherson in 1944, New York City, who investigates the murder of a young, beautiful woman named Laura Hunt. Her face has been blasted off by shotgun pellets. He falls in love with a portrait of her on the wall of her living room in her apartment, and she turns up alive, and they fall in love. Think of me. Think of my past. Think of the construction of a lonely, haunted police detective falling in love with the portrait of a dead woman, and she turns up alive, and you'll understand the allure for me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's funny, because a number of film noir fanatics, I do know a couple of those, questioned, like, wow, is Elroy really the right guy for that? And I said, have you read his books? I mean, this is like the character that it's second nature almost to you. So it surprised me not to discover that you pursued this. I didn't know whether it was something you were after or whether somebody just had the brains to come to you and say...
I've been after it like a pit bull for 20 years. Yeah.
Okay, fantastic. Now, what about the info that I saw today that you and David Fincher are talking about coming up with something for cable TV? What do we know about that? Anything to that?
Yeah, there's something to it. I've known Fincher for 15 years. We get along swell. He's the preeminent American film director. Zodiac, a film that you and I love, a luminous work of art. Surely the great San Francisco motion picture. And
James actually gave me his tickets to the preview
screening.
He couldn't make it that night. Yeah,
I'd seen it in L.A.
Yeah.
I wrote a script. It's set in Los Angeles in the 1950s. We're in negotiations with the cable network. It'll be announced if they come up with a scratch.
Yeah, it's always the...
It's the
Give
scratch.
Me your... movies have been... I'm not going to say they've been good to you. Because there have been some, you've made some dough out of the movie business, but they've done some fairly poor adaptations of your work. What's your take on the movie business in general these days? Having as you announced at the top, been born in the classic film noir era, what's your take on the business now?
First of all, money is the gift that no one ever returns. The color green is always flattering, and the size large always fits. I will never turn down a movie option on one of my books, nor do I expect to see it realized to the degree that the Curtis Hanson Brian Helgeland adaptation of L.A. Confidential has been realized. That's a once in a novelist's career proposition.
What I love about L.A. Confidential, the movie, is I created the world, and only I could have created the world. And Helgoland and Hansen gave me an alternative world in a mode that I never could have imagined, that is recognizably my world, yet their world, and a luminous world unto itself. It is Elroy Light in some ways. There are performances that I don't care for, and it doesn't matter. It's their world, it's my world, it is an occurrence, it cohered in the Spiritus Mundi, and here we are.
I wish I could read this question. It sounds great. I'm going to ask the person who wrote this. It's America is flat. What happened to us? America is flat.
America is flat. What happened to us? Put down your cell phones. Don't text message. Don't log on to your computer. Read books that you buy in bookstores. Go entire days without checking your phone messages. Seek God however you choose to understand God. Quiet your mind and devote your inner self to the pursuit of meaning. And if this woman here, this man here, this man with the peach-colored necktie, the man over there with the sunglasses tucked down his shirt, the man with the great head of hair, his eyebrows could cover my entire face. You. If we do that, and more people do that throughout the world, in all time zones, across all continents, gender barriers, racial divisions, faiths, colors, and creeds, then the world will assume its normal proportion once again. Those of us here in this room may not be here for it, but we owe ourselves to try. Yeah! I'm a deep heavyweight guy. You can tell.
I'm not going to go after the God part of that.
What?
I'm not going to go after that. Well, I think that's a lot of the problems are right in there, but that's okay. I appreciated the way you said it, but I don't think many of those people that you're trying to talk to are going to take it quite in that spirit. Do you have a favorite among all the books you have written?
Perfidia.
I knew that was the answer, of course. But okay, do you have a favorite character?
Kay Lake. I think she's my most brilliant creation. Writing from the perspective of a brilliant, madcap, hilarious, brilliant, beautiful, brutally willful, fatuous young woman in way over her head in 1941 has revolutionized the way I see the world.
A while ago, I thought I understood your books because it seemed to me that the unifying theme of all of them, besides the men always being horribly fucked up, is that the only chance they had for redemption was through the love of a woman.
Yeah.
Is Kay that woman?
She's fictional, and I acknowledged the viable indictment of onanism and narcissism at the beginning of this talk. She is that woman as the voice of the secret human infrastructure of history.
Okay, very good. Okay, if there's Anybody else have a question that, for Mr. Elroy, that did not get written down on the cards?
Does anybody want to ask me why I write? I'm listening.
Sir, what motivates you to write every day? I assume you write something.
You want to know why I write, huh? In my craft or sullen art, exercised in the still night, when only the moon rages and the lovers lie abed with all their griefs in their arms, I labor by singing light, not for the strut and trade of charms upon the ivory stages, but for the common wages of their most secret heart. Not for the proud man apart do I write on the spindrift pages, but for the lovers, their arms around the griefs of the ages, who pay no praise or wages, nor heed my art or craft. Dylan Thomas.
Okay. All right. Our thanks to James Elroy, author of the new book, Perfidia, and to the Bernard Osher Foundation for underwriting this program. We also want to thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. I am Eddie Muller.
Eddie Muller, ladies and gentlemen.
This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.